This is The Conversation. It's episode 126 with Kim Abeles, artist and pioneer of loft living in downtown Los Angeles back in the 70s up until today. And the story here, well, you will hear about that story. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this show is theconversationpod.com, where you can check out images of some of the lofts that Kim has inhabited over the years, as well as her work over the years. So go check that out. I like the way this episode piggybacks on the last episode, 125, with New York artist Colleen Asper, because she and I talked about her bizarre rental situation in Brooklyn, place that she basically got kicked out of. And though she consulted a number of lawyers, there was ultimately nothing to be done. So that's an interesting scenario. We also talk about her involvement with Occupy and her teaching at 14 different art institutions and some of the gender inequity she has experienced over the years. That's episode 125. Go check that out. And Kim, you know, it's a story not only of her work and her public art, her smog art, it's also a story of artists and real estate. And she's actually going to be moving out of town to a certain extent, keeping a place in town. But it's an interesting story. And I would really love to hear from any of you that are involved with some kind of exodus out of wherever you are, or maybe downsizing to a smaller place or moving to the suburbs or what have you. I know those stories are going on. So if that's you, we'd love to hear from you. In the meantime, why don't we get to that conversation with Kim? First, I want to let you know that we are co-hosted today by Julie Orser, who co-hosted with me on the recent Jeff Weiss episode and was a guest herself. The episode of The Crit, about the Michael Asher taught class, at legendary class at CalArts. So no intros, let's get right into it and stay tuned on the back end where I will give you a little more info. Thank you very much for being here in the meantime, and I will talk to you in the back end.
Abeles. Okay, I know it's a hard one. I've heard like a million.
You've probably
ways.
Heard everything. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I sometimes think, oh, maybe I should have picked that other one instead. Like that other pronunciation, because Abeles is actually my first husband's name. So it's not really my name even. I mean, it almost feels more like a stage name. So it, you know, like occasionally I'm like, God, I think he used to say it that way.
What's your original name?
Wright, which is
with
very
a W.
Simple, yeah. Yeah. W R I G H T, like the Wright brothers.
Right, right.
You know,
good patrician roots.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Where are you from originally?
Mostly Pittsburgh. That's where I really grew up.
Right. Okay. Because, and I think that's not just a sort of mixer question, because I think you, from the what I know about you, seem to be like a quintessential pioneering LA artist, you know, because you've been there for 30 years now.
35.
So you were there when it was pretty desolate. It was like Soho in the early 70s.
That would
kind of equivalent.
Generous.
That would be generous. Yeah, well, fill us in on what it was like.
Because also, like, I live on Traction now, and that's where Al's Bar used to be, and that was kind of the only thing that you would maybe go to that street to attend. And even that, as like a single female, I'd be a little hard-pressed just to have gone down there to hang out at the bar by myself. It was like that. So, you know, those kind of changes, because now I look out the door or the window, and I don't even really recognize it, to be honest. So it's really like day and night. And all those changes, though, you know, like gentrification, I told you, caught up with us finally. And I mentioned to somebody the other day that it's kind of like death. It's like, you know, it's going to happen, but then you're really surprised when it really happens. And you just are trying to adjust to it, you know, like, and So in a lot of ways, I don't fit in there anymore in what the kind of grunge factor that I always was attracted to in the downtown area.
That's all gone now.
There are parts of it that are still like that, but you can see that that's slowly going to emerge into what the rest of it is. And I think it's really a great thing on a lot of levels. I mean, they're building it up to be a place where you can really walk to shops and stores and for your groceries and to see your friends and to the art store and so on. And it's safe for people because there's so many people walking around on the street, and that's really what is required for safety in any neighborhood. So, I mean, that's all a really great thing. And some of those old buildings that were left derelict for so long are now like these gorgeous places, so you can at least go in and see the lobby, if not the rest of it, but at least you can see all these beautiful ceilings and so on. So I'm all supportive of that, actually. I think that's a good thing.
Well, I think instead of wondering about this, we should probably just ask it, and that is there any way that if it couldn't have actually happened that you had bought your place, you know, is there any kind of looking back in shoulda, coulda, woulda?
Oh, there are a million of those. You mean in terms of
the place that you've been in? Yeah, but particularly the place have you been in the same place you're leaving for 35 years?
I've been in this place for around 8 years.
Mm.
And prior to that, I was just like a two blocks away on another place that had a very serious condo conversion, like Diane Keaton bought one of them, and you know, that sort of thing. So
there goes the neighborhood.
So I'm still in that neighborhood, so I still pass that building and have many memories, of course, you know, of the way it had been. And I mean, they just gut these buildings when they do it and kind of begin again. It's just the shell. But you know, the first space I actually had downtown was on Broadway in the Victor Clothing Building. And, you know, for me, at 10 cents a square foot and living there, and I lived there illegally, and at least for the most part, at the beginning, I was really the only one living there. Everybody else came in, like Larry Pittman was in there, and Roy Dahl, and John Valadez, and, you know, I could just list off a lot of artists. Linda Burnham with High Performance Magazine. And so I was on the fourth floor, and in order to live there, I made this bed that was as big as my body so that when they came in, it didn't look like a bed. And I had my clothes in a crate that you'd lift open from the top, and all my clothes are very neatly on, you know, hangers in this rod with a thing that looked like a whiskey still that was my hot water heater that somebody rigged for me after seeing I was taking cold showers, and I'd wheel it down the hall in the night and hook it up to the bathroom so I could get hot water. So, wow. You know, you go from that to what's down there now, and it's just like it's apples and oranges, I guess they always say, you know, like you can't even like compare what kind of living that is. But see, I love that. I thought that was like just an amazing relationship between people and artists that were down there and kind of eking out a living. And you could live cheaply because the spaces were cheap, and you could kind of, I'll sell a piece because I can't pay, you know, my $100 for the rent today, right? Yeah. So, I mean, it's hard not to get nostalgic in a situation like that.
Right. So it's lucky, and even though you're leaving, and you should probably tell us about that. But you did have those years where you had the glory days to yourself, almost, right?
Yeah, it was really a very sweet time. I you know, performance was really big then. I know it's really reemerged again, but you know, those first iterations of people kind of suddenly doing something on the street and you just happen to walk by and see it, there was a lot of that kind of thing going on. And Osco and Harry Gamboa and all of them were, you know, very active with because of people that had studios around. And it was really a particular group of artists, I think, that were there. And so, you know, I mean, well, you know, now you have, you know, like Hauser Wirth and Schimmel going in again, like on that street two blocks away I mentioned. And, you know, I walk by there while they're constructing it, and I don't even know what to call that. It's so huge and beautiful, and it's just awesome in itself. They could leave it empty, and it would be, like, exquisite in a sense, right? Mm. So I don't know how art fits into spaces like that when the spaces themselves are just full of, like, a certain haunting and marvel.
Mm. Hmm. So did you come to L.A. from Pittsburgh?
Yeah, I did. And I came to go to grad school at UC Irvine.
Mm.
And I guess I gravitated pretty soon after I got there to downtown because, you know, like growing up in Pittsburgh when the, you know, the steel industry was still active or just starting to go out, it was kind of dirty and grungy, just like downtown L.A. had been when I saw it. I just felt really immediately like, oh, this is where I'm supposed to be.
Uh-huh.
But I had gone to undergrad school at Ohio University, and I kind of need to say that after school, I actually lived in the countryside for a few years and lived in a grain silo that had been converted into a home. And I mention it because going really more from that, and, you know, I wrote a crafts cookery country living book when I was in my 20s there and did all that kind of gardening and, you know, back to the earth things, and in an area where all the architects around made these handmade houses with, you know, no electric at first and kind of hardcore wood stove living. And then, you know, then I come to grad school and it's like, ah, you know, you know, I came here as a painter, and the last painting that I did, I actually cut it up and made wallets out of it, you know, because I was so used to being like practical about stuff. And everything sort of had a secondary feature to it that you might make into something else.
When did you first move downtown then? Right after grad school?
At the tail end of it.
What,
like,
so what 70, year?
79. I first moved in. Donnie Silver Simons had this huge space. It was at the least 3,000 square feet, maybe larger. And I had this little teeny corner at first, and then at one point she moved out, and then I took over that kingdom and had that. So, you know, it was really great. I mean, you know, you'd go to Clifton's cafeteria in the morning to go eat breakfast, but it wasn't like it was now. It was kind of weirder because it wasn't.
Well, it just reopened again.
No, I know. And now you could sort of imagine it looking like that. But I think at the time you thought you just walked into a weirdo place. And I haven't. Have you been there yet?
No, I haven't yet.
I just wondered what the food was like because it was just, you know, very simple cafeteria, almost like hospital food. You know, oh, get the Jell-O now, and, you know, oh, there's an omelet over there. I think that's an omelet, that kind of thing.
Right.
So,
right. Should we fast forward and then go backwards?
Yeah, I don't know.
No, actually, I think to give it people at least one taste of your work, since this kind of came up when we spoke on the phone, one of your friends, when you told them you were leaving, they said, I'm surprised you hadn't, they said, it sounded to me something to the effect of like, I'm surprised you hadn't left earlier with what your work has been about, because one of your big bodies of work has used the smog of Los Angeles. Just a practical kind of maybe pedantic question, but if you did one of those pieces now or in the last few years, would you still get that same kind of gray-black coating on the objects?
I can still put them out there, right. And you can. I mean, you know, they've done a lot with changing vehicle, you know, laws and so on. But as long as you have a lot of cars on the road and trucks, after all, not all of them are going to be smogged, you know,
right.
And yeah. stuff and compliant and everything. So I get that. But also, you know, a lot of that is like small bits of rubber from your tire fly into the air, and they're very small particles, but we breathe those in too. And then, of course, other types of, you know, there's still factories downtown and stuff. And so all that cumulatively does create that.
So you use everything from porcelain to, I assume, your daughter's baby chair.
Right.
And you put it up on the roof of your building. And how long did you usually leave them up there?
Well, typically I'd do a month because it was an increment you could understand. Sometimes a week for the same kind of reason. Or one time it was during the LA riots, you know, the rebellion. And I happened to have all these presidential seals on the rooftop. And so all that ash from the air, if you recall that, was floating through the air from the fires. And so because that was a real particular incident, I pulled them down right after, so that it was really more the ash in the air. Mm. So that would happen. But those presidential commemorative smog plates, those were actually so that if the presidents had bad environmental records, I left them out longer. So they ranged from like 4 days for Jimmy Carter. I really will always think he was really the best trying president in our lifetimes. And then like Ronald Reagan and Bush out for 40 days. So you do see those grades of gray on that with their quotes about the environment and industry on them. So sometimes they were put out for purposes to really understand an increment of some type. And
was that cathartic, putting out for the longer periods for the Reagan and Bush?
What do you mean?
Was it cathartic for you? Like, because that's the kind of the way you described it.
Well, that it would get worse. I mean, I'm into, you know, as an artist, you can also punish people. So I saw that, you know, I'll get them, you know. Like, I've done artworks out of, like, my jaywalking tickets and stuff before. Because it's sort of like, as an artist, it's your last recourse to be able to be creative and make something out of tragedy or things you're pissed off about and so on, you know.
That's actually, the jaywalking thing is a recent, very recent phenomenon from my perspective, because there was a whole radio piece about these various people who were getting these huge tickets downtown, and it was supposedly part of the further gentrification movement, basically. But I'm guessing that it happened to you a while ago.
Yeah, this was, I still remember, I would have to think back what year it was. I did a lot of stuff with like parking tickets and jail receipts from people I was with and stuff like that, you know. That was a bad time, but anyway, I still remember getting that jaywalking ticket, and there were two cops, and I mean, it wasn't even like a busy intersection. These guys just happened to be there. And I was having a bad day anyway, and I literally, like, took their pen and I threw it on the ground, and I stormed off, and then they remembered, oh, shit, we still have her driver's license. And you could tell they were like, you take it to her. No, you give it to her. You know, because in the end, aren't we all just people out there, like, interacting? I don't care how many rules are out there. In the end, it's just you and me. And, you know, you think it's going to have a certain semblance of order to it, but that's never really going to be how life is. It's just, like, whatever goes.
Well, you were in downtown when it was, as we talked about, pretty vacant. Was there any police presence back in the day?
No, I don't remember. remember that. I don't know where they were. I mean, you know, like that police station is new downtown, so I'm trying to think where the original one. Yeah. Yeah, so I don't know, where were they? I think, you know, it's funny you say about something like that, because then you make me think, yeah, I don't quite remember them. There were people living on the street then, but it was really not as intense as it is now. I mean, they on Fifth Street, I don't know if they still refer to it as the Nickel, but that was kind of traditionally, even in music with Tom Waits and stuff, they would call it that. But it was more that you'd see individual people. I mean, it's like a serious issue now because people need homes, and this isn't like a handful of people. You know, this is like a major sub-city that's there that needs to be, I mean, especially I think of women and families on the street. That's really tough. I don't even know how people have the strength to do that. It's pretty impressive they survive as well as they do.
How have you noticed, you know, over the years being downtown that the homeless population has changed in relation to where you've lived?
Well, you know, because it was less, I would say, I mean, I'm sure statistically they even know that, or by numbers, right, that it was less then than now. Like, I did a piece about this one man that I saw every day, you know, kind of when I would go on Broadway. And I spent months on this book of writing about him and my fantasies about him in the dark room and, you know, my thoughts about him and his life, and did pieces about him. And when my dad would send every Christmas, like, fancy cheese, you know, selections for my, I don't know, what would that be, Harry and David cheese,
right,
or something? You know, I'd always like split it with them. And so I think those kind of relationships you wouldn't really have a chance to cultivate anymore, because people are, you know, they're always on the move, you know, and, yeah, and there are too many people to really do that. Actually, last weekend there was a carnival downtown that the Union Mission had sponsored, and it was organized in part by this guy, Joe Moeller, that used to do the LA Art Walk on Thursdays. And anyway, when I heard it was down there, I said, oh, I've got all these embroidered leaf pillows that I've made for a project. I said, I'm really wanting to hand them out now. I've exhibited it many times and it's ready to go out there. So we actually went and took about 100 of these hand embroidered leaf pillows and then gave them to people as pillows to sleep with.
Wow.
And it was cool. And it was actually the first time in a long time I had that direct interaction with the populations on, like, mostly 5th, 6th, and I guess 7th streets. And, you know, it's kind of this huge area down there that's more or less demarcated, where everybody, you've seen it when you've driven, and the tents and stuff. See, they didn't have that either in the past. Like, that was an ordinance that allowed people to camp on the streets. And the word camping became a term. And so that's why, oh, okay, tents. Right?
Yeah.
So those kind of ways of making it work have been in part of the way the city has dealt with it. I mean, or not dealt with it is more like it, I guess.
Right, right.
What was the reception to the pillows?
Oh, it was really neat. And I'm, you know, I didn't want to take photographs. It just seemed too, like, no, don't do that. So I kept trying to eat up the image in my eyes. The reception to the pillows was really wonderful. I mean, like one guy used to be a tree cutter for the city. So he, if anybody, was like super careful which leaf he picked out because they were all done 5 times their normal size, embroidered with the name of the tree and where it was originally found in the world. And each one, the color and the textures were based on that leaf. So it's not like these were generic leaves. These were very specific, different leaves. So, you know, people would try them out like as a pillow. A couple people were going to have them for their little dogs instead. And so I just felt like that piece landed where it was supposed to land. And I love the thought that, you know, now when we drive downtown, we're always on the lookout, like, oh, there's one of the leaves right there. You know, like it's such sort of a peculiar thing to think your work is sort of, you know, scattered in an area that you'd maybe by circumstance just see it.
Mm-hmm. How long ago was that?
This was last weekend. Yeah, this is like, you know, still pretty fresh in my head.
That's very fresh. Is this the first time you've given out work like this?
I gave out holy cards that I made of Saint Bernadette once. I even did it in Lourdes where she had seen the Virgin Mary, put them in like telephone booths. And that was in the mid-80s, actually. Hmm. So I made 900 of these holy cards. Richard Duardo, who is a really wonderful printmaker, helped me with the prints. And actually, I should say his sister, Lisa, was the one that physically, you know, like, how many of these are there? It's, you know, and they each had a little lock of hair on it. And then Bernadette, I painted the portrait so she's bald on it, sort of like, you know, like a movie star. You'd want this little thing you'd take. Mm. Right, and then they end up with nothing, that kind of thing.
I was thinking of when I asked you about when that was, because it seemed like an interesting contrast giving away work to the numerous collections that your work is in. And, you know, it sounds like it's easier to do a gesture like that when you also have the collections balancing it out.
Wow. I would have to give that, no, I'm intrigued by that. And, you know, because also the day I did it, I also then went to the Disney Concert Hall. My friend Barbara Cohn gave me tickets and we saw a concert there. So the contrast, like there I was and then I went there. And I told her where I had just been and she said, oh, that would have been neat if you would have given out the pillows there and simultaneously at one of the art fairs, because which one was going on then? LA Photo was going on, I guess. And wasn't there another one going on? Well, at least there's like one, right now, there's a bunch of them.
Yeah, there's one this weekend.
Yeah. And so your thought also makes me think about that kind of contrast also. But I don't know. I'm intrigued by what you're saying because I don't know what to say about that. Julie?
Julie is pleading a fifth here as well.
Well, it makes me wonder. I mean, are you thinking like there are these hierarchies and then you have a certain freedom if you've already broken into the ones that you're always like, you know, as artists, we're all like crawling on each other, like, I'll get to the top before you.
And well, that's true, but that's not necessarily what I was thinking when I had that thought. It was more that, wow, she's giving away this work that she obviously, you know, put a lot of time into and a lot of love into, and that you would give them away. I was picturing all, you know, the long list of collections that your work is in, and I think it's easier. It seems philosophically easier to make that gesture when you have it balanced out, as opposed to somebody who's just out of grad school, say, you know, they're going to make a bunch of body of work and they're just going to give it away to Skid Row.
Right? That would seem more like a gesture for
it would be a stunt.
PR, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, which is also why I was very reluctant in the end. Like we have, I had a photograph of the leaves like at my studio, right? And then my reluctance to take it further because it did teeter on these quandaries in a lot of ways. And it made me feel maybe a little rebellious, you know, like, it made me feel, I loved that it was a big gesture. I just felt like it wasn't just that it was like this pillow, like, hey, here's a pillow. It was like, oh my God, I can't tell you how long all those took, you know? And I had given a half of them away to like children's centers. Like it was originally, I guess I should say, at the Contemporary Arts Center in Cincinnati. They're the ones that commissioned me. And then it was up for like 3 years and they had built that Zaha Hadid building and then they shifted it even. And then when it was coming down, I said, oh, let's distribute them to like kids centers and stuff. Because the original idea, there's 500 of them, some are the size of surfboards, and you actually get to jump in them and shift them around, shift that geography of their locations so that they're borderless, basically. So it almost had more to do with geography than it did leaves, in a way, or trees.
Right. Well, I'm thinking of now you mentioned about feeling rebellious. Do you feel like you've led a rebellious life? You know, I mean, it feels, just to go back to our original conversation, it feels rebellious to be downtown, you know, in the pioneering days when it sounded like, you know, your safety was to go from your place to your car to wherever you were going, right? You didn't walk around the neighborhood.
Or wheeling a boiler down the hall for a hot shower.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So what about that?
Well,
is that rebellious?
I mean,
I'm kind of asking a rhetorical question.
Right. Okay.
Almost like, yeah, what about that? Let's see. You know, I have this phrase I've used before that I like work that you kind of lick the sidewalk. Very visceral, right? And I guess it just suits, it comforts me to have to be in some kind of raw setting like that. I just feel a little anonymous, and not that everybody doesn't walk in down in cities and stuff, but I do like that feeling that maybe it's like being in the Grand Canyon or something, you know, like your size is the way it's supposed to be, which is basically pretty small, and to kind of try to keep it that way, kind of humbling, I think, is a good thing to always try to do as a person, you know. Because especially for the art world, and both of you really know this, I mean, there's many reasons why your head starts pumping up, right? And it's all a little bit artificial. It doesn't really have to do with the creative spirit of it or the struggles you go to trying to get to a place with your work. And so anything that kind of reels me back into the reality that, hey, basically I like doing work about the world. And if I'm not willing to be out there in that world, you know.
Yeah, it sounds like downtown was really important for that, to ground you and make you have that sense of place.
Yeah, it felt just really right to do that and to observe it in a real natural way. I mean, you know, sometimes people really get annoyed at my work because it seems didactic or something, or, you know, I have themes in the work that are real subjects that, you know, you could research or something further. And but that's not really how I see the art-making process at all. It's more about walking around and, you know, things kind of coming together in peculiar combinations. And the fact that they're about subjects is just because I'm out there.
Mm-hmm. Right?
When you say didactic, the people who have leveled that against you, are you talking about writers or other artists or both?
Well, yeah, both. Yeah. I mean, I guess it's come more maybe from artists, like, you know,
They come up to you at your opening and say, well, this is a really didactic.
No, I just think, well, you know, also, I guess it's also true that things have changed a lot. I mean, now I think it's maybe more acceptable to have topics, when you also agree. And I think that, like, in the 80s, when I was doing, like, okay, I'm going to spend 2 years on the Dead Sea Scrolls and the history of them being found, and or many other topics through the time. You know, Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, okay, this is really important. That at the time, it probably looked really out of place, maybe. I mean, that's my impression. Like, I did a lot of work for a number of years about HIV prevention and the AIDS in the time of the AIDS crisis, when it was like Reagan was still in power and stuff. And I know that, you know, sometimes people will come up to me and go, well, wouldn't you be better off volunteering at a clinic or something? And it makes you wonder then, where does art function in our society? But I think we've advanced quite a bit, don't you believe? I mean, now artists are on think tanks and do interdisciplinary work with scientists in all fields. And, you know, so that's a really wonderful trajectory that happened. Not that that's for every artist. I mean,
mm-hmm. How did you respond to people who said that to you?
I was really hurt. I'm really sensitive. You know, that really struck a chord, because it's sort of like artists make the kind of work they make. Hey, if I could make abstract work, I would totally do that. But that's not at all how I think. And it's not, you know, I don't even, you know, you go in the direction you go as an artist. And I think at some point you just have to accept, well, this is the kind of work I make. What's kind of funny to me about how many genres we've had, like, didn't it, like, mount up, right? It's like this huge checklist of stuff that artists could make, or maybe students when they're trying to find their way. And it's mystifying, like, how does somebody, like, why are you making that work instead of that work? I mean, there's something to be said about maybe people get influenced by a teacher or an artist they respond to, but there's something more than that that has to take place. And, you know, to kind of get the courage up to go, well, this is what I make, you know. And
did that take a long time for you? Like, was there, like, ever a shift or a moment in which you felt like, okay, this is what I make? So what if you think it's didactic?
No,
so what if you think I should do community work?
You know, no, see, because that kind, I didn't even think of it as community work then. As far, I mean, you bring up the point that we've named some of these things now, like community based, right? Socially engaged. It's like
social practice.
Mm-hmm.
Social practice. Yeah, I know. And I mean, that's there. It wasn't there. You were just making this stuff and asking your coworkers, hey, you got any clothes you want to give me? Because I'm going to make this installation, you know? It was just like...
But who are your coworkers? You were, weren't you on your own?
Oh, see, you must be sort of a mind reader, because...
You made that up, didn't you?
No, I didn't make it up, but that was probably the funniest job I ever had. There was this book called the Joe Carbo's Lazy Man's Way to Riches, and it was kind of a pro-mail order book in the second half, but the first half was self-help. And I was a ghostwriter for their newsletter. My name was Casey Joe Richardson, and people would write me and ask me for advice. And it was early on in the computer, so you'd go, you know, everything was coded. Like, a paragraph would be called, like, a B3 or an A24. And so you'd read their letter, and then you'd go, they need a C2. But anyway, the people I work with, they gave me a lot of supplies for installations and sculptures I made. You know, like, sometimes they'd clean out the back room, and then I remember there was an envelope on my desk one morning, and it said, hey, Kim, here are those mice you wanted, which I didn't know about it, but I opened it up and there's these three little mice, all like dried up, almost post-fetus period. Slightly bigger than Icky, but had some form to them. And sure enough, they ended up in a piece. But so.
Well, you were, you know, in contrast to the whomever the artists that said your work was didactic, the institutions seem to love that style, right? And it makes sense, too, because, you know, you have school groups and whatnot that, you know, where the docent or the teacher can really dig into some kind of social narrative.
Yeah, again, I think that did it. That did proceed that way. I think it was quite by accident sometimes at first that I got to be in places, unexpected places. But I agree with you that I think it's also bigger in an institutional way that museums slowly found they could get money more easily if it had an attachment with education. And so whatever that looked like, it was kind of a natural fit. And I still like, I think for me, anytime I was working with groups or like if somebody asked me to do a workshop, I think they're all still a little shocked, like how into it I get. It's not like, okay, you're giving me $200 and, you know, we'll do this workshop. It's like, no, you're giving me $200 and now we're going to do this major production. You know? Because to me, that is my art. Even if I can't immediately identify it as that, I'm very aware that I was always such a big fan of like Dada work and the fact that you'd have these chance configurations, and chance is exactly what people give you. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh yeah, on paper, this is what we're going to do. And then suddenly you go to these situations and it's like, nobody's cooperating. No, you're not supposed to use that side of the paper. You're supposed to use the other side that I spent all that time painting, you know, that kind of thing. It's just a kick. It's Julie, it's probably like you when you do films and stuff. It's like you think you know what's going to go, right?
Yeah, you can't. Whenever you're collaborating, there's always an element of that, for sure. Yeah. And then for you, you collaborated with, like, science people and the automotive bureau and lots of different types of people with lots of backgrounds. I'm sure you had a lot of experiences where the collaborations would go well or surprising.
Actually, you know, they always go well. I guess it just depends what you call well, you know? Like, I think they went well, and I think people in the end are usually pretty satisfied with what's going on, but I think everybody's a little, they don't know really what to expect because the work is so process-driven that, you know, that's the only freak-out I ever get with groups or institutions when I try very hard to describe to them what we're going to do just to satisfy them. I really wouldn't describe anything if I could get away with it. Because to me, if that process isn't allowed to go the whole way, then I might as well not do it. I like that little bit of mystery on how this is really going to turn out, or, oh, well, let's try this and see how this information that other people made could really be valuable in a visual kind of way, that kind of thing. Or how do you do projects without using people and or infantilizing people or, you know, making them into a kit or something? And I've made actually art kits before for projects just because I hated the art kits you'd get in most workshops. So, you know, I just hated that. So I was like, okay, we'll make a kit of identical, you know, little materials. And here's your box. Okay, make anything you want.
Well, let's talk about, since we kind of alluded to it before, your move to the foothills or whatever the right word is, right?
Foothills would be low.
Okay, it's to the mountains.
Well, actually, what's a foothill then? Am I at the foothill? Is it? I don't know.
Well, if the mountains are
flatlanders, people that go up and move to the mountains.
That's right.
You heard that before? Flatlanders?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Wasn't Jeff using that term or no? No, he was using another term. But no, I've heard flatlanders. Jeff didn't use that term, flatlanders?
He might have.
It's not a compliment. Okay.
No.
I don't believe.
Well, wait, it's people who are butting into their own community. Gentrifiers.
Oh.
But you're not a gentrifier.
Really? I'm going to have to actually look that up in like an urban dictionary then. I thought it was because people come from flat and then they go up to the mountains and, you know, go, oh my God, there's a bird.
Oh.
That's actually kind of what I thought it meant.
Too. Okay. All right. Well, maybe that's what
I
it
don't
is.
I know,
then.
Though. Maybe we're wrong.
It's a real bird. I thought it was like a stuffed bird. It's like.
So where are you moving to?
Okay, so what happened was I looked all around town after we found out that we had to go.
Did you at any time ever want to buy your building that you're in downtown?
Yeah, but that wasn't going to happen. I mean, yeah, for like $1 trillion.
It's basically like as an artist, even, you know, except for maybe the period when you first came to L.A., in the 70s, you're always a step behind where you can actually afford to buy, right? That's basically what happened.
Good point. Yeah. I mean, because remember at the point you're talking about where you probably could have gotten a building, like say 1981 or mm-hmm. something, right? It's like, that's when I was also remember paying about $100 rent. So
why would I buy?
That sound like an investor.
Right.
Yeah.
Or even that it was in my thoughts, to be honest, you know, yeah. Because I always thought it was kind of a poor American dream of that. But the only reason we thought to do it this time is that kind of every 8 or 10 years I've been pushed out. And I really don't feel I can do that again. And all I really want to do at this point is do my work and whatever accomplishes that was a good idea. So I think it was more about that impetus than wanting to be a land baron or something, baroness or, you know, like that. So anyway, in Crestline, which is 1,000 feet lower than Arrowhead, so temperature is more mild. And it's an hour and a half outside of town, and even a little less if there's no traffic. And then we got a little apartment in town just to
have a base. Oh, you've got it covered.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, I'm like breaking out in hives thinking about it all, honestly.
Wow.
But I do think it's really a great thing. And I'm really curious how it ends up informing the work, too, because of what we were saying about the environmental work and so on. I mean, does it still happen and I have a distance that allows me a different lens because I'm not in the midst of it? Maybe, you know.
Sorry to be so detailed, but where is your apartment going to be in town?
It's going to be just on the outskirts of Highland Park because I wanted to be near the Gold Line mostly. And then my daughter and her family lives in that area. So it was all kind of strategic. The only downside, honestly, is that my mother is 96 next week. No, Friday. She'll be 96 on
wow.
Friday. And she lives in Little Tokyo still.
Wow.
Wow.
And she's fine and all, but she refuses to go with us. My husband, Ken Marchione, is a photographer, and he of course, is part of this whole move. But I tried to coerce my mother, and I guess we're to the point where we'll wait for something disastrous to happen, and then she'll join us.
Is she out and about on her own?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Wow.
Yeah, she doesn't drive, she walks, but in Little Tokyo you can actually do that. And
do you worry about her?
Oh yeah. I mean, I worry somebody will arrest me that I didn't like, you know, put her in a proper setting. But to be honest, when I get that age, if I'm as fit in as she is, I'll be furious if somebody's forcing me to do something.
Yeah.
I mean, really think about that. And I guess I want to be respectful of
sure.
her. We've talked about it till I'm just like, you know, exhausted about it. And she seems fine. And everybody knows her. She's just like, you know, she wears these Tom Ford huge glasses and styly gal. And, you know, I mean, much more stylish than I am. I'll just never look like that. It's and so everybody kind of caretakes her as she goes down the street.
Wow.
Amazing.
Have you ever considered making art about that? Or does that seem too invasive?
You know,
invasive?
Meg Madison did... these prints, beautiful sun prints of women over the age of 60. And at the point where I was going to be one of the subjects, I said, you know what? I can get you a gal that's even older, okay? So we took my mom down to the LA River, and that's where these sun prints were made. If you go on YouTube, you can see it. Have you seen it?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I did that. And then, you know, I interview my mom now and then. Sometimes I videotape her as we're doing things. And, you know, it's hard not to want to do that. And I know, Eileen Cowan actually did her dad, you know, in projects. And Jim Goldberg did his father. And I'm trying to think, are there other examples of people with... elders, Judy Fiskin did her mom. It was at the last LA Made in LA show. They had that. I think it was the last one. But you know, it's very compelling to do that. I did buy the website Moving Mother, meaning because I did move her here about 3 years ago, but also the notion of trying to move this woman, like emotionally. It's been a long haul.
She's got a good poker face, it sounds like.
You
those
know,
glasses.
It's the glasses. Yeah, very distracting.
You moved her from Pennsylvania?
No, I moved her from Gulf Shores in Alabama. She had gone to one of my openings. I think when I was just, maybe it was a grad school reception or something, and she met this man who was a brother of a friend of hers. And when I went to go pick her up to take her to the airport from her place, she was staying with him that night, and she answered the door, and I saw, she's not going to come with me. It's like, she's dug in with this guy. And then they married like 5 weeks later. And then he took her there, to Alabama, to the Gulf Shores, which is prettier than you would suspect.
Right.
But
and then he moved on and then you rescued her?
Actually, he was killed in a fatal car crash.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, he went quickly. I'm not good at death, okay? It's just like...
Well, she's here now.
Yeah, she's here now, so...
That's just quite an image, you know, a 96-year-old woman living on her own, walking around little Tokyo amidst all the gentrifiers.
I know. You know... I always wonder if they're laughing at her, you know, like there's a part of me that it's so particular down there, the whole vibe of, you know, a lot of plaid and I mean, you know, it's really very particular look to it there, right? A lot of cool handmade soaps and coffees and you know, and then there's my mom always walking back and forth to the studio. My daughter actually works at the Pie Hole. You know that restaurant down there?
No, tell us.
Savories and sweet pies.
Oh.
And so I know my mom will be able to keep walking back and forth to see Zoe, so.
That's nice.
So that's okay.
Yeah.
So.
It's going to be a really big change to go into the mountains.
Are you think picturing you'll, it?
Yeah, I'm trying to. I'm thinking, like, are you going to be there all week and come to
like
the city on the weekend?
Half and half. Oh. But, you know, sometimes, well, Ken work teaches at Art Center and also at Cal State LA. So a lot of it is because of that. But some of it is because I still do a lot of public art projects, so I do need a base to be able to have meetings and show people, you know, models and things like that. So part of it is that, but I really suspect I'm going to start getting more and more dug in up there because I do like seclusion quite a bit, actually. I mean, surprisingly, in the city, you do get seclusion in your own way. It's just it's very noisy. So I think, you know, eventually the ringing in my ears will go away. And then, you know, I'll see how that goes.
It actually sounds pretty idyllic, you know, being even 5 days or whatever it needs to be that week up away, you know, on a mini vacation and then into the city when you need to.
Yeah, I think it's okay. Because, I mean, I needed some space is what it was. I don't, you know, I'll never have the kind of studios I have when I first came downtown. I mean, you know, it started at like 3,000 square feet, and then it went to 2,600 square feet, and then it went to 2,000. And, you know, so I'm not shy about, like, the old feminist notion that you make art on a kitchen table, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, that's okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, live creatively is always the way to go. But on the other hand, I do build stuff. And so I do need to be able to do something. And I mean, at least I'll have the choice right now, you know, because of having space up there. It was more about that in a way than anything.
So will your garage be your studio? Or?
Well, it's actually got, Ken said, when we went in this one house, you can have the whole downstairs. And as soon as I heard that, I was like, I'm in. Because I looked and I saw it was really, like, proportionately great. It's a 1960s house, so it's built in a really kind of peculiar mod kind of way. And, you know, I am really scared. I mean, I'll be the first to say it, and, you know, is frightening. But I think anytime one makes a change, okay, once you make your decision, you just run with the ball. I mean, that's the way to go. I quit teaching maybe 10 years ago, and it was kind of the same sort of thing. It's like everybody around me was like, oh, I can't believe you're doing that. And, it, you know, the economy was tanking and... And then, you know, you just go with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it actually kind of shook everything up in me. You know, the kind of the trauma of moving. In a way, I feel so alive. I feel like I feel every nerve ending in my body right now. Now, maybe that means I'm getting ready to have a heart attack. I don't know. But I do really feel like I can really see you two as if you're, like, extra in Photoshop. I can see, you know, like,
so all
oh,
the...
let me fix that thing on you.
So all the adrenaline has gone straight to your eyeballs, it sounds like, to your retina.
Oh, yeah, you're right. That is what it was.
Well, it's gone there and other places.
It's supposed to be in my stomach, isn't it? I don't know. I don't know where adrenaline's supposed to be. I'm going to look that up, too.
Yeah, you're going to have some post-podcast homework, it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you have anything else?
I was just curious when you started doing public art projects.
The very first one, well, you know, I did a collaborative one, Larry Salton and Mike Mandel up in Sacramento, but I kind of didn't consider that the first one. That was maybe in the maybe 1990, something like that. But, you know, the guys kind of took over after a while, and the gals, myself included on the team, we just like drifted into the Netherlands or something. So I kind of don't consider that one. It was on the Secretary of State building up there. But then the first one I actually did was a library in Panorama City. And the thing I love actually about that library reminds me, I work with a student and he did a little film on me at one point, and it kind of came up about that library, and he said, oh, that was my childhood library. And the fact that then he and I knew each other, but, you know, people don't really look on the label of who makes these public art pieces. Not really. I think artists maybe do, right?
Right.
Yeah. But just the typical person, they either enjoy it and they like it, or they hate it and or move on. And I like that aspect, that there's this thing out there that is very out there but very anonymous simultaneously. Like near here actually is the Walk a Mile in My Shoes. Have you seen that? The traffic islands?
Yeah,
it's a replica of Martin Luther King's shoes, and then shoes of the civil rights marchers. And then a mile from here at Jefferson and Rodeo are the local activists of their shoes and their biographies. So, like, that's another example. I go out there periodically, and I just go out there with a broom and I sweep it. or I brush off the tiles and things. And each time I do that, I think, oh, this is so funny, isn't it? This is sort of like being in your studio, but I'm not. I'm on a busy street, and I'm just like in my zone, like looking at these people that eventually I befriended many of them, the local activists. And so that's kind of a personal piece, because there are many reasons why these people were picked in different communities and stuff. But that outdoor stuff, it's permanent, right?
Yeah.
So any like pain and sorrow that goes into making a public art, at least you know it's there forever. And shows go up and down, and that gets kind of sad after a while, I think.
So when you've been sweeping there, have people asked you anything like, well, why are you doing that?
Oh, yeah.
Are you the artist? Did anybody actually say that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, and I'm one to volunteer that, hey, I made this, man. You know, and often they go, you did not. And I'm like, no, really, here's my ID, you know, like, look, there's my name there. When Zoe, our daughter, was little, I used to take her around to the public art pieces that I did and make her sit there with me while we watched people interact with the pieces or not, you know. And sometimes you get some cranky old guy that would go, I hate art. And so I would go, well, my mom made this. And, you know, like I did manhole covers on Hill Street right outside of Grand Central Market, and people spit on them. And it's sort of like, oh, I just love that. You know, it's like that is the true commitment there, right? So.
So for people listening, the in A Walk a Mile in My Shoes is on Jefferson and Rodeo on one end, and the other end is
Rodeo and Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard.
Okay, if they want to check it out.
Yeah.
So maybe catch you sweeping it.
You may.
If they're lucky.
Yeah, you may.
Although, after you move, it's going to not be as
yeah,
often.
No, I'll still come down and okay. do that. And I've done a lot of different things with Dorsey High students, because Dr. Semple, who's their principal, is one of the people I featured in the Jefferson site. And then Ken and I had made a relationship with that school. And Elizabeth Oral Roses does different projects with them. And we've gone in and made videos with them and so on. So, you know, sometimes that's the other weird thing that happens with the public art. You begin to have a relationship with communities that are new to you because you don't live in that community necessarily, but it gives you a different tap into a group of great people. And I love LA. I mean, I will say that's maybe a good closing remark. I love this city. I think this city is the most wonderful, diverse city in the whole world. We can do that. Should we tell the mayor this? don't close the thing with
Chamber of Commerce. Chamber of Commerce, yeah.
You don't need to close with
that. Hire Kim for your next public art project.
Right. You don't. But I truly, sincerely do like it. And that's why I like all the outside interaction. Because you walk down a street in L.A., in many areas, right? It's not just downtown, but many of the areas. And, you know, all the languages, all the diversity, what people wear, what they are curious about and looking at, it is so enormously different one to the next that you think you know what people are like, and then you realize you didn't even begin to tap into what people are really about.
Mm. Well, that's a good one to end on.
Instead of the...
Kim, this has been great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Oh, thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Julie.
Yeah, thanks, Julie. You guys got me so wound up. Oh, my God.
Didn't seem like it.
Well, you were so, like, attentive. It's like, oh, I have this little print that I bought. I'm still trying to find the guy that made it. It's, you know, in those cases in Denny's where you get the toy. You know, with the claw.
No. Right.
And it's a sweet little etching. And there's the claw. And there's this little stuffed animal going, pick me, pick me.
That's going to be our outro. And we're out. Thank you so much again to Kim Abeles for talking to us and giving all that wisdom and experience to you guys. I've been having conversations generally with a younger set of artists, so it's great to have some wisdom on the table every once in a while, and Kim definitely delivered that in spades. I hope you guys enjoyed that. I want to thank recent guest Eileen Cowan for connecting me with Kim. Thank you, Eileen. Want to remind you that this is a listener-supported show. Your support of the show in any way possible, in any way that you can, is very much appreciated. I really want to thank the few folks that have donated quite generously recently. Thank you guys very much. You know who you are. And if you would like to make a donation, you can do so through the website, theconversationpod.com. It's quite easy to donate there. Just click the Donate Now button. And there are other ways that you can support the show. You can leave a nice review on iTunes, which will help other people find the show. Of course, word of mouth is very much appreciated. And thank you to those of you who are spreading the word as well. You can also, of course, follow the show on social media, Instagram. I appreciate you new followers on Instagram. Thank you. Twitter, and of course, Facebook. And if you go to the conversation page of Facebook, please like the show, because we're getting near 1,000, and who knows, you may be eligible for a special Pick Me Denny's toy machine prize. So, you know, I don't think that's something you want to pass up. Thank you again very much for listening to the show. If you have any comments, of course, at any time, social media or directly through the website, love to hear from you, and I love seeing those emails saying that I got a donation, so just keep that in mind if that's something that you can all afford. Thank you very much again, and I will talk to you soon. Ciao for now.